Streaming live around the world, this is Paper Cuts.
Why don't we start our own show?
With Brad Proctor.
I forgot to break up my fancy straw.
You sound insane. Do you realize that?
And Jay Maddox.
We're called Paper Cuts? Who came up with that name?
We need like some name tags with our picture on it, all laminated and whatnot. I mean, we gotta look legit, man.
We are live.
Wait. Let's do a head count. Brad, are you here this time?
Look at my lights over here. I got
welcome
them.
Back, buddy. All right.
Thanks, man. Thanks for holding down the fort last time.
Great. Hey, everyone. What's going on? Thanks for joining us. Jay Maddox here. Thanks so much for stopping by. The one holding the show together like Elmer's glue. Thank you.
I mean, someone's got to do it.
Yeah. So with me, I used to be able to say with me all the time, but
I've ruined that already.
After last week, I guess that doesn't count anymore. Hey, everyone. Say hello to, I know it's been a while since you've seen him. Say hello to Brad Proctor.
Hey, everybody. What's going on? Welcome to my channel.
All right. We have a special guest this evening, but before we get too far, I want to dedicate the show. I want to dedicate the show.
She's going to hate you.
To the one and only Laurel Hightower. Hi.
Who are you again?
She's gonna unfriend. I see it right now. All right. I'm just gonna throw it out there. In 2011, Sugar Bowl, Ohio State 31, Arkansas 26. Thank you. Your guest this week.
I was there and I was sitting with a bunch of Ohio State fans. So,
and just tell us how horrible of people were they?
You know, most of them were pretty good, except for the guy sitting right in front of me.
Except for this guy right down here. Yeah. Jay, was that you sitting right in front of him?
I thought my buddy was going to get into a fight with the one sitting right in front of us.
I'm sure it could have happened. Trust me. This dude has probably as many books as Stephen King. We were just talking about it off the air. Still a little bitter about that Arkansas loss from 2011 Sugar Bowl from the Ohio. Hey, everyone, say hello to Mitch Seaborn. Hey, thanks for stopping by. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for being here with us.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
What would you be doing on Friday night? Yeah. What would you be doing on Friday night if we didn't drag you into the show here?
Probably watching the Andy Griffith Show with my wife and cats.
Nice.
It's exciting around here.
So you're watching the black and white version or the color version?
Oh yeah, just the first five seasons. It's got to be black and white, and it's got to have Barney in it.
So. It was not funny once they colorized it. It was like
it was so bizarre looking.
Yeah,
to see it in color.
Yeah. Hey, welcome to Andy Griffin chat on a Friday night, guys.
It's my fault.
you back shit.
So I'll ask a serious question.
Okay.
So in your Amazon profile, it says you are a lawyer. Are you still a lawyer or are you past that now?
Yeah, I'm still a lawyer. I'm still
someone super smart here with us, Jay.
Yeah. So next question. I'm in a little bit of a bind. we'll just talk off air.
I got you. All right.
Yeah.
What kind of law do you practice?
You know, I started out when I first got out of law school, I was working with a friend of mine from law school, and we actually did quite a few criminal cases. Nothing too heavy, but and here lately, a lot of family law. I'm working on a couple of divorces, and I actually just got done with a probate case as well. So I'll just give the generic answer and say a little bit of everything.
A little bit of everything.
That's all he's allowed to tell us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you being a lawyer, have you pulled, like in this book, Dust in Time, I just read, you have a character that's an attorney. Do you pull anything from your real life experiences and put that into your books at all?
Definitely a little bit.
Yeah.
I won't give names, but there's some real life influence for some of that guy's background in that book. Totally that's fictionalized, cool. Of course, but the influence was there.
So with you being a lawyer, how does writing get wrapped up into this? I mean, how do you have time to write on the side? And secondly, I mean, you're doing like horror stuff, also being a lawyer. That's
I also teach high school English, so I keep my
he has no time.
Look, I can't even get my short story collection done, and this dude's got like 18 jobs and 25 books out.
Yeah, no, I taught high school English. Then I left it for a few years and went to law school and got licensed as an attorney. And then I know people don't believe this, but I really, really enjoyed teaching high school English. Mm-hmm. And when I had a chance to go back to it, I decided, you know, I'll just keep my caseload down to a few active things. And I'll see if I can go back to teaching full time as well. And as far as when I write, during the summer times, I love to just wake up and spend the morning writing. And, but during the school year and when I got a lot of stuff going on, sometimes it just happens really, really late at night, or sometimes I'll be multitasking and just typing stuff in the notes on my cell phone. And then it gets copy and pasted into the Word document later.
You gotta love smartphones. Make it easier for us.
Yeah.
So when you're teaching your high school English, do you ever pull out your books and say, here's a good example of what to do, and then share it with your class?
No.
Do they know? Do they know you've written all these books?
Most of them do know I write. I mean, I'll tell them I write. I don't like give them Amazon links or anything like that.
Hey, guys, for extra credit, if you buy my book.
It's inevitable that at some point during the year, one of my students will say, hey, I discovered you. And they'll like pull up every image that Google has of me. And it's really awkward. But I don't bring my own books into the classroom. It's, you know, there's nothing too bad in there, but there's stuff that I wouldn't read to a high school class either. So
yeah,
I leave it at Shakespeare, To Kill a Mockingbird, you know.
Do your fellow teachers and fellow attorneys, do they know you write horror?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Do they ever give you like sideways looks like, what are you doing here? Are they pretty?
You know, one of my books actually takes place. It's Lamentation. It's a few years old now, but it takes place in a high school setting. And I have a few coworkers I've worked with over the years that say, I know where you got, you know, that particular character, that particular thing from. I still remember that. So, yeah.
Do they ever think that you're just doing research for your next book? He's not really a lawyer. He's just, you know, he's just sitting here pretending, you know.
I just have to tell people that if you write enough, then every day and everything you do is research for your next book. I mean, and being a teacher and an attorney, those two fields do give you plenty of material to run with. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Now, some of your books are actually poetry, right? Or do you mix in poetry with your...
I have tried poetry and I quit trying.
Well, I mean, I had 20 questions about that. So, hey, thanks for being here, guys.
No, I published. I was telling Brad in some Twitter messages as we were getting ready for this show that I published a collection years back that had some poetry I had written in it. And because of that poetry, I unpublished it and it's no longer available.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So there's the WPS down there. You got to make the noise now, Mitch.
This is really awkward.
You don't have to. I'm just messing with
you. You do. It was in the contract. Did you go for it?
Woo, pig suey.
Oh, sorry.
Can't help it.
So you don't write every day. You try to write in the mornings, but during school year and during your heavy times of being a lawyer, you do find it hard to find time to write. You're taking little notes on your smartphone and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I do try to write every day, but some days it's honestly 4 or 5 sentences. And then some days I'll sit down and write.
You know, I mean, that counts. That's something. Yeah.
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 I try to keep my head in my book at least once every day. That's for sure. But I don't always get hundreds or thousands of words written at all.
Do you ever feel pressure to try to hit a certain word count every day, or you don't really worry about that?
You know, when you're in one of those runs where you know you've got some opportunities, like I'm off this whole week and I really don't have anything pressing on me, I feel pressured to, okay, let's make it count.
Yeah.
I mean, I try to publish at least one or two books a year. And that's nothing compared to what some people do.
But some people crank them out like once every couple months.
Yeah. But, you know, I do try to take advantage of opportunities when they arise, knowing that I may get busy and only be able to scratch out a few sentences some days. So,
Well, I was going to ask, what do you do? What would you be doing if you weren't writing? But since you have two other jobs, I would say sleep.
I have a lot of interests that keep me busy. I mean, I love to read. So, I mean, again, I'm sure what I read over the course of a year is nothing compared to some people, but I try to read 30 or 40 books a year. I love to run and I love to hike. I just got back from Colorado. I mean, I love to hike in the mountains when I get a chance. So, and I play a little bit of guitar. Nothing I'm willing to do on air here, but I do have plenty of hobbies. So if I wasn't,
we could probably set it up for you if you want to go ahead.
Yeah, no, we can rock it out. Jay's got a pink guitar; he could rock out with you.
I do. I have touched that thing in like 7 or 8 months, man.
So was that your? I saw your pictures on Twitter where you went to the Rockies. Is that your first time you've been out there?
No, I've been going to Colorado. I usually go with my dad. And he used to hike a lot of them with me. We like to go out there and hike the Colorado 14ers, the 14,000 foot mountains in the Rockies. But I've been going out there with him for about 10 years now.
That's cool.
And I'm trying to, I can't remember how many, 50, 54 mountains out there, at least 14,000 feet high. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to check them off. I want to climb all of them. And I'm about halfway there. So.
So it's 14,000 feet for a mountain. Is that considered big or is that small? Or
by the United States standard, that's as big as you get outside of Alaska. But you know, compared to like the Himalayas or something, it's not nearly as big.
Pretty tiny.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong. I can't remember the name of the book. In the one for Off Limits Press, did you write a hiking short story for that, or was that somebody else that wrote that?
No, I wrote. There's another one of my real life influences coming in. I wrote a a story for the Far From Home anthology.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, about an attorney who buys an old building that used to be owned by this dead mountaineer, and of course, it's the mountaineer had his own tragic past, and it's a ghost story and everything, but. My experiences in the mountains and, you know, being an attorney looking for an office space, that played into that story.
I always feel like stories feel more authentic when you pull in real life stuff. Like Stephen King always writes about writers, and this book had the attorney in it. And I knew you were, and asked Jay about the book he was reading, if that had an attorney in it, if you sort of did the same thing Stephen King does, but with attorneys instead of writers.
I didn't get it done. Full disclosure, I did not get it done.
Shame. I finished this like 20 minutes before we went live. I got it done.
It's a pretty quick read.
It is. For me, I've burned through it pretty quick for how fast I read.
So I got no reading.
Tuesday or Wednesday.
Damn job. But you were talking about your influences. Who are your major writing influences?
I'm sure you've heard this a million times.
Not at all. I bet this is original. I've never heard of any of the writers you're about to say.
No. My big influence is, I'm not sitting in front of his books right now, but I mean, like so many, Stephen King got me into it. I read Salem's Lot when I was a kid. Yeah. And that was my big leap into, you know, adult fiction. Before that, it was Goosebumps and, I read Clive Barker's The Thief of Always, and that really opened my mind up too. But when it comes to if I could credit one writer, it would without a doubt be Stephen King. Been reading his book for 20 years now.
Yeah.
Salem's Lot was my first book, but I just got into him, I don't know, maybe 6 years ago or so now.
Yeah.
I didn't read it all like through middle school and high school. I didn't read anything.
Yeah. I didn't read.
I've got a lot of catch up to do.
Yeah, I didn't really get into reading probably till maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was a kid, that was 3 years old when Friday the 13th came out and I watched it. So it was more movies for me when I was a kid. You know, back then, before books.
Before the internet and really before the internet.
Exactly. Yeah.
I've been reading since I spent the first 10 years of my life or so, you know, I swore through elementary school that I hated reading. And my mother was worried sick because my mother's a big reader. And she thought, oh, my kid's not going to like to read. And then I really got into Goosebumps in like the fifth grade. And so credit R.L. Stine, too. He definitely got me into reading. And then Stephen King.
See, I totally missed the whole Goosebumps thing. I was too old by the time it came out. And I kind of want to go back and check it out. Like, I'll try to make my kids read them. They don't care. do you make your kids? You have kids, right?
No, my only kids right now are some cats.
They probably take more time than real kids probably do.
Yeah.
If I ever do have kids, then I think, and as a teacher, I see it too. I think kids need to be read to. Mm-hmm. So I would definitely read to my kids, and I would try to get them into Goosebumps. I think there's still something there.
I think we have some Goosebumps roaming around the house somewhere. I think they like the Netflix series, but that's not the same. So
I still have probably all of my Goosebumps books from when I was a kid. They're over here in a cardboard box. So I think me and you, Mitch, are probably about the same age. So I was really big into them too when I was little. And then once we got into like middle school where they made you read, I think that's where I lost my interest in reading because it felt like work at that point instead of it being picking up whatever you want and just reading for fun.
Right. I had a teacher that tried to ruin it for me, and I try never to do that with my students because, like, I want kids to want to read, and I try to make even the stuff I've got to teach that I know they're not going to be into, you know, Shakespeare and that sort of thing. I try to make it fun, and I try not to spoil reading for them. And I'm always I read a few young adult titles every year, so I can have some good stuff to recommend for them. But I had a teacher that tried to ruin reading for me. She tried to kind of police what we read. Like, I remember trying to read Stephen King's Cycle of the Werewolf in her class. Oh, yeah. She said, we're not going to have those devil books in here. So I just hid my devil book behind one of her books. And I think she knew it and just quit picking that fight with me. But
see, that's the thing. They want you to read, but then when you pick what you want to read, it's not what they want you to read. I mean, you can't have it both ways. So
I agree. If a kid's wanting to read, I think you need to let them read
whatever
they want to read.
Exactly.
Whether it's a comic book or graphic novel, at least they're reading something.
Space erotica or whatever, space
erotica. That's Jay's favorite subgenre, space erotica.
That's my new channel launching tomorrow.
So do you ever try to, not necessarily sneak in, but do you ever try to incorporate anything in your high school class that is more sort of current or popular or anything besides like Shakespeare or, all the old stuff you have to teach?
I keep a few bookcases in my classroom of, current modern books. I've got some, I bring a few of my extra Stephen King books in there, and the school's pretty good about buying me boxes of, new material. And so current young adult books, I've got some John Grisham in there, some Stephen King, just anything I can find that I think, hey, a kid might like to read that. Cause, I don't want it to just be the dusty old dead guys that my kids see in my classroom. I'm trying to get them into reading. So I'm trying to give them some cool current stuff too.
Yeah.
Do you feel like they take advantage of that?
Yeah. A lot of them do. They, and Neil Schusterman. A lot of people think they don't want to read young adult stuff, but Neil Schusterman has a series called Scythe about this future where human beings have basically defeated death and you can't die naturally anymore, basically. And so the government has to pay these, I think they pay them. I can't remember. It's been a couple of years, but they have these things called Scythe that patrol society, choosing who actually has to die and not, come back.
I've heard of that series. It's like black and red on the cover, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, it's a really good series. And I'll read something like that and that I can really kind of hook them with. Mm-hmm. Like I'll tell him, there's a scene in that where a kid discovers that he really loves the rush of jumping off of high buildings because he knows it's not going to kill him. And you tell them about stuff like that, their eyes just get real big and they can't wait to read it. So I try to keep them in with current stuff too. And they're good about checking my shelves and taking stuff out of my room. And, you know, I've gotten a few of them into reading anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds good because it sounds like they're actually really getting into it. And as long as they can pick what they want, I mean, they should be enthused with it.
Yeah.
Is there a favorite underappreciated novel that you have?
Underappreciated novel?
Yeah, since you have to, you know, kind of show them some of the Shakespeare and Hemingway and all that stuff, but you try to sneak in some of the other ones. Is there one that's not, that's kind of underappreciated that you slide in with them?
That's kind of tough. One of my favorite books to read with them that maybe isn't on every high school curriculum is I know I'm gonna mispronounce his name. Night by, I think it's Elie Wiesel.
Oh yes, I've read that. That's a great book.
Yeah, it's great. It's short. You can cover it in just a week or so, and it's about the Holocaust and a family's time in a concentration camp. And
yeah,
it hits hard. And I mean, that book's been very appreciated over the years. Yeah, that. But it doesn't pop up in high school classrooms maybe as much as I think it should.
It totally should. It won the Nobel Peace Prize in 86.
Yeah.
And there's sequels. I think it's Night, Day, and I can't remember the third one. But this one's amazing read. It's real short. Like you said, it's like, I don't know, 100 pages.
Yeah.
Barely 100 pages. It's good.
And there's some stuff in there that you don't forget once you've
read. Oh, yeah. It's super dark.
Yeah.
I don't go too much into it. I remember the scene where the guy was like stealing the soup. And then they just blew him away, just blasted him.
Yeah. And I remember the scene where the family's being split along the two paths. And, you know where some of them are going, and it's into the furnace, basically.
Yeah.
And it's heavy.
I mean, it is. And it's really well written, and it's like his biography, autobiography. It's really happened to him.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah. That's a good recommendation. That is a really good book.
Yeah, it is.
So your school is pretty open as far as the reading goes. Is there anything that they banned? Because when I was a kid, I snuck a copy of Huckleberry Finn, you know, and I read because my school had it banned. And it wasn't their decision. It was like, you know, the whole school board's decision, you know. Yeah. And I also read Tom Sawyer, everything else by Mark Twain, but there's a lot of stuff that's banned. Does your school have anything that's banned, that's totally off limits, or are they just totally open for whatever you're suggesting to the kids?
Yeah, I teach at a very small school, and I've been blessed. Shout out to my boss if he happens to see this at any point.
we'll send him a copy.
Give him a raise.
He's been great to work for. I don't know of anything within reason. I mean, there's stuff I wouldn't bring into my room for my kids to read, but I don't know of anything that's banned. Okay. If it's anything that I think might be too controversial, I'll go to my boss and say, I'm thinking about covering this. You think it's a good idea?
Right.
And he's always been supportive.
That's cool to have a boss that's supportive of what you want to do too.
Yeah. I remember years back I did Frankenstein with my AP seniors, and I wanted to show the movie. I think it's from the 90s. Robert De Niro was in it, I think. Yeah. Anyway, it's rated R. And I asked him if I could show it in my room. And, you know, knowing the group of kids I had, I knew they could handle it, and he did too. He said, yeah, they've seen worse in their sleep. Don't worry about it. So not every teacher has that experience, but I've been lucky like that.
That's good. Justin here, he's basically saying the same thing. He had a teacher that said Stephen King was trash. I feel like a lot of, I don't know, like professorish kind of people say that he has no literary merit, like Justin's saying, like he's not good. He's just shock value kind of stuff.
See,
I think it's wrong, because I think he does. I mean, he's not the most literary author ever, but he has some literary.
He doesn't
talent.
Just do horror. I mean, because his first, you know, five or six or eight books were just, you know, straight horror, he got that reputation. But if you look, I have his whole library. If you really look deeper into his library, it's not just horror stuff. So,
Especially a lot of his newer stuff is more crime, mystery, thriller kind of stuff. But he goes kind of deep with some stuff.
And I was reading a book about Stephen King at one point that said, you know, if you don't think he can write, just read that first like paragraph of The Regulators.
Yeah.
It's extremely poetic and descriptive. I mean, he's talking about, I forget, there's a description of lawn sprinklers in there.
Yeah.
He describes it as
I love The Regulators. I'm the minority with that because people like, what's the other one that came out during that time?
Desperation.
People like that one better, but Regulators took place in Ohio, so I love it.
I think, you know, not only is Stephen King a better writer than, you know, read Stephen King and then read like James Patterson or something, and you'll see how good Stephen King is.
If you but can not even only that, James Patterson book that he's written now.
I was going to say, he doesn't even write him anymore, does he? It's just his name.
He's got like a corporate headquarters somewhere or something. He does. Not only is he a good writer, I think, Stephen King, but I mean, you know, some of his stuff's pretty challenging, and I think it's worth your while to read it. And anything that gets people into reading like he did me, I mean, I was reading Stephen King and then give it 20 years and I'm trying my hand at Les Miserables. So, I mean,
he always talks about something, you know, that has to do with the current climate too. He throws that in there. It's not just, you know, completely horror crazy stuff. He's always making some kind of point about the time and place where he's writing the books.
Yeah, I think if somebody 100 years from now wanted to see what life was like at the end of the 20th century and the early 21st century, you know, just read through Stephen King's catalog, you'll get a good look at America over the span of that 40 or 50 years or so.
Yeah, I would definitely put him, and that's just me, I would put him ahead of, I know we have the classics, Shakespeare and the Hemingways and all that stuff. I try to read a lot of those classics. That's on the, you know, top 100 classic list. I was bored out of my mind with a lot of them.
I just can't do it.
Yeah. I mean, the wording and everything, just the way it's presented. So, yeah. Is there an author that you may have disliked earlier, but becoming a writer yourself, I've grown to appreciate them more? That's probably a loaded question, but you know, it's Friday honestly, night.
It's more along the lines of being an English teacher, but I hated reading Shakespeare when I was in high school. It was tough and I hated it. And I thought anything that requires this much effort, I mean, why bother? But having taught Julius Caesar and Macbeth and stuff like that for 10 years now, you know, my family makes fun of me, but every now and then, maybe once a year, I'll just take that big Shakespeare book off the shelf and read a new Shakespeare play. As far as other writers, kind of the reverse. I went from being a big Dean Koontz fan about 20 years ago to now kind of bored with Dean Koontz. I feel like he's written the same book about 60 times.
I've heard that. I've never read his stuff, but I hear it's kind of just rinse and repeat.
Yeah, I have about 10 of his things right there. I have not read one of them.
Kind of boring. There's some good ones, but I would say once you've read 5 to 10, you've probably
read them all.
This may be unfair, but you've probably read them all.
Yeah.
Especially the last 20 years or so. I just know there's always a golden retriever.
It's just a dog. I was going to ask, you being an English teacher, when you do read for just, you know, pleasure and fun, do you think you look at books differently than you would if you weren't an English teacher? Or can you not separate it since you've been a teacher for so long?
I think I do a pretty good job of separating it because I'm not one of those that I don't think of things as literature and then popular entertainment. I just, if I read it, I like it. Uh-huh. Not if I read it, I like it. But if I like it, I'll read it. And, you know, I'm not looking at things for their literary value. I think I do a good job of, if I get a book in front of my class that I'm going to teach, yes, I can teach the literary merits of it. Mm-hmm. But I'm not digging through books just seeing, what's the literary merit here or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, am I connecting with these characters? Is this a good story? I think I can separate my high school English teacher self from my just reading for pleasure self.
Yeah.
How's the support from the family with your writing?
It's great. My wife is always, after I've got a couple of drafts in and I've cleaned it up, she's usually the first one to hear it because I want to read it aloud at some point. Mm-hmm. She's good to sit down and listen to me read it aloud. My mother is a heck of a proofreader. she's got an eagle eye and she always reads my stuff and proofreads it for me.
So it's all in house.
Yeah. My in-laws have, you know, my wife's parents have actually bought a bunch of my stuff, even though they could come down and get it for free.
Yeah.
But, no, the family's they're very supportive. I hear some writers say that, you know, outside their spouse or something, their friends and family don't buy a lot of their stuff.
Right. Giving them that strange look at family functions. Yeah. I know what you wrote last year.
Yeah.
So since you let your mom read it, has there ever been anything like, oh, I don't know if I want to read this. It's a little racy for mom reading it. Has there ever been anything like that?
When I was first starting, because I've started writing in high school, as far as trying to actually write, you know, stuff that I thought I might try to get published. And it was a little awkward handing her some of that stuff. I'd write it. And then I'd water it down right before I hand it to her.
Yeah.
And then maybe throw it back in later. But
you're getting the clean down version.
She's got the special edition. Yeah.
Yeah. Nowadays, no. I mean, I'm a grown man. She's grown. Yeah. It's fine.
So is this actually your mother-in-law here in the chat, Juanita Lynn?
That's my mother-in-law. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
You got the support on the live chat and everything.
Nice.
Yeah. She, I'm not sure how she found out about this. I guess she saw it on Twitter.
She followed you on Twitter?
How did you get here?
I think she follows Paper Cuts.
Now we can't talk about him at all. We gotta be really nice. We can't talk about
Yeah.
Y'all do
no,
what you
no
need
custom,
to do.
Brad. Yeah. So as far as your stories, the ones that you like, the ones that you promote the most, you said you have like six or seven of those that you were really, you know, proud of. Where did the ideals come from? Just everyday stuff, or are you like on a subway one day and think of something? And
I mean,
Jay, subways in Arkansas. Come on now,
look, that's a different country, right?
We have a subway here.
I don't think we have one in Kentucky either.
I'm at the restaurant.
Oh yeah, the subway.
I mean, I do a lot of traveling, so I've been on a subway. But,
yeah.
I can go through it. You know, I said there was stuff I'm proud of and some I'm not. I was telling you guys before the show actually started that when I was very young and naive, and I thought everything I was writing was like, oh, I'm the next Stephen King. I was throwing stuff out there trying to get it published, and I landed with Publish America for a few books, and I mean, credit them for printing my books, I guess, but they probably shouldn't have been published. They weren't very good. And I was kind of glad when Publish America went under and quit emailing me, trying to get me to buy crates of my own books, and they went out of print. And that's probably
they actually did that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
I mean, you'd check your email and there'd be 10 emails in there from them saying, hey, authors need supplies of their own books. You know, how many hundred do you want to buy? And, but when I discovered Kindle Direct Publishing in like 2013, 2014, it was kind of in its earliest days. I started publishing with them, and everything I've written since about then, I mean, I feel like I learned something about writing over the years. And, the four earliest books I published from that time, I've collected in a book called The Funeral Mountains.
Nice. I have that one.
Yeah. It's the first two things I ever published through KDP and a couple of more recent novellas. And, I mean, I'll be honest there. The inspiration for, most of that stuff came from traveling. I mean, I called it the Funeral Mountains 'cause there is a mountain range with that name out near Death Valley.
I was going to ask if that was a real mountain range.
Yeah. I've done some hiking out that way. And it inspired a couple of the stories in that book, and it inspired a short story that's in my collection that's about to come out. Lamentation was directly influenced by my being a high school English teacher.
Yeah,
the main office at our school used to be this really cool old two-story building. And we couldn't use the second floor anymore because there was no handicap access. Mm-hmm. And so that whole second floor just sat empty. It was just for storage and stuff like that. And it was really spooky up there. And so, the idea for a haunted school building started to percolate in my head. And then I did this really crazy thing before I took the Arkansas bar exam a few years back. I decided it would be a good idea to go on a vacation to Alaska right before I took that test instead of studying for it, I guess. In my defense, I had been studying relentlessly for like 2 months, and it was my way to just kind of take a breath before I went and took the test. And that inspired my book, Toklat's Daughter.
Okay.
I was in Denali National Park thinking of how huge and vast this place is, and somebody could disappear out here and you'd probably never find them.
Yeah.
And so that started thinking, hey, what if somebody wandered out here on a trail and just never came back? And that was the inspiration for that.
That's a nice parodying book.
Yeah. and then I wrote Folklore. It's about small town Arkansas and a lawyer who, starts to believe he might be turning into a werewolf. Mm-hmm. Sounds kind of crazy, but I think that book works. I wish more people had read that book. I think it's really good take on that. I mean, not to pat myself on the back, but I think it's a really good take on the, I just think, some of the vampire werewolf stuff needs to be just stripped down and taken back to where it all began.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I tried to do there. I tried to write a classic werewolf story.
I should have read that before Dustin Time since they
connected. Yeah, there's
it didn't really spoil too much, but they are connected, which I think is cool.
Yeah, it's the same. The Riley Saunders, the constable, is a repeating character there. Yeah. So, yeah, just life experiences and travel and just reading a lot of books. That's pretty much what's inspired my stuff.
So the werewolf one for James, it's called Folklore.
Folklore, yeah. I didn't mention the title. Yeah.
And Dustin Time is a pseudo sequel, you could say.
Yeah. You don't need to read one before the other, but just know that the main character, Riley, is in both of them. One of my reviewers said Riley probably just needs to move to another state and find another line.
Get out of Arkansas.
Yeah.
You can go to King Route and just, use the same names, have the Mitch Seaborn universe,
Yeah.
Go for it.
I was going to ask, do you have any other books that connect, or is it just those two?
Not really. I don't think I've ever written I've never written a true sequel. Mm-hmm. And I don't really like, I like to write standalones. Mm. I don't want to stay in the same universe too much. Now, I'm not saying I won't do an occasional Stephen King type thing and reference something that happened in another one of my books.
Right.
But I'm not opposed to that. But it's as far as bringing characters back too often or writing sequels or anything like that, no.
You feel like you have so many ideas, you don't want to get pinned down to keeping everything in the same universe?
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
I mean, to me, writing is almost like a way to travel inside my head, and I just like to go new places. I like to tell new stories in new places. A lot of my stuff is here in Arkansas, but a lot of it, I really like it out west in the mountains, mm-hmm. and the desert and all that. I love that. So I like to get out there as much as I can and just tell new stories. I don't like to stay in the same universe too much.
With using KDP now, how do you feel about having to use social media to kind of promote your own work? Is it just something that you realize you have to do, or do you feel dirty when you do it sometimes?
Yeah.
Pat yourself on the back.
Yeah. I appreciate you guys bringing me on tonight because I'm not too good at stuff like this, and I'm not good at throwing myself out there. Like,
we're not good at this either. So we're all the same.
Look what we're doing here.
Yeah. I'll send a promo tweet every now and then. And, it may get retweeted a few times or whatever, but I don't like doing it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't come natural to me. Like talking about myself does not come natural to me at all. I'm not good at just throwing myself out there to all these different bloggers and reviewers and stuff like that. Like, hey, I'm here. Can I come do an interview or whatever? That does not come natural to me at all. So it's a struggle.
Like, I feel like some of the writers we've talked to, they're kind of all in the same boat. They feel kind of awkward. Hey, check out my book.
I tell myself that everything I've heard about traditional publishing, I mean, it's much the same way. I guess if you're lucky enough to land the top 10 and you're on a rack in the front of Barnes and Noble,
right?
Some of your promo does the work for itself. But even with traditional publishing, I feel like writers are asked to do the heavy lifting when it comes to promotion. So there's really no way out of it. I mean,
it seems like Twitter's like the form that everyone wants to use. And I get so confused with Twitter because I get on there and I don't know who has posted stuff all day. If I get on it at the end of the day, I'm like, how do I find what people have done? You know, I'm confused with it, but I mean, I'm also old. So Brad had to sign me up for it. Like, I don't know what's going on Twitter half the time. I'm like, let's see. I wonder if this person done anything.
That's another thing. I love and hate Twitter. And it's my only social media. Like, my family tells me you need to get an Instagram. I don't even have Facebook. Facebook's
probably the worst.
Yeah. I don't have Facebook. I don't have Instagram. I didn't know what a TikTok was until some of my students at the school started telling me about it. But I mean, on the one hand, Twitter is how I've, you know, Well-Read Beard and Josh Marcella and Laurel Hightower and some of the great people in this community. Without Twitter, I wouldn't know who they are. I wouldn't have a fraction of the sales I've got. I also know that I'd probably have like 10 more books written if it weren't for Twitter.
I'd have like 20 more books read this year if it wasn't for Twitter.
Yeah.
TikTok, getting in those TikTok loops.
Jay will send a TikTok and then I'll watch that one and I'll flip to the next one. And then an hour later has gone by. Yeah. And I'm still watching TikTok.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's horrible. Jay,
that's the real reason why I can't get my short story collection done.
Because TikTok
video, and it just starts it. So,
I mean, I sit down to write, and it's like three sentences. Check Twitter.
Read three pages. Hey, what's going on Twitter? Or the kids come interrupt. Or
is anyone talking about me? Yeah. Am I tagged anywhere?
It is like a double edged sword though, because you have, and nowadays you have to do it, especially as you know, small press or independent. You have to have some sort of social media presence to put yourself out there, or no one's going to ever see you. But then you don't want to, either you're not very comfortable doing it or you don't want to be addicted to it all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very fine line that fence to cross.
And my Twitter account's this really, really weird, like, I guess I'm not good at marketing myself. Like, my Twitter account during a Razorback game is 50 tweets in a row, like cussing the Razorbacks or something.
I see those tweets all the time about the Razorbacks.
And then the next morning, I'm back to trying to promo my books or something. So it's like,
you need to make the Mitch Arkansas Razorbacks fan account and then the Mitch the author account.
I need my fellow Razorback fans to be patient while I talk about books, and I need my router friends to be patient while I grope about the Razorbacks. So
as if it wasn't confusing enough, just go ahead and make another account. Add to it.
There you go. Because we have the Paper Cuts account and then our own, and I always get mixed up and post something on the wrong account.
Like, I stopped. I did it for one day. And I was like, I'm done.
You handle it, Brad.
Yeah, you take care of that part.
I really don't need another username or password. So
it's too much. Do you want to go ahead and you want to play a little quick game real quick?
Yeah, is this
some lightning round?
Oh, wait.
I'll give it a shot.
What are we doing as far as time goes?
Let's do 60 seconds. I think that's what we did with Megan.
Did we do 60 seconds? I thought we did like 20, didn't we?
Nah, we did 60, I think.
No way. Is she here? Megan, are you here?
No, she ain't coming back. She's like, I'm done with them guys.
Oh, she showed up last week, I think.
That's because I wasn't here.
Because you weren't here.
Yeah.
Wait, so let me find the stopwatch here. Okay.
These are super serious, you know, life-changing questions we're going to throw at you.
I think we did 30. We can do 60, but I think we did 30.
Okay, well, let's play the video and we'll jump in.
Let's do it again.
Do it again? Okay. Well, that's our budget for the entire year.
Really? We have to lay somebody off.
It's me. That's why I wasn't here last week. I didn't get paid.
All right. One of us won't be here next week for because of that.
You got the clock? You got the clock going?
Yeah. So what we're doing, 30 or 60?
Do 60 seconds.
Okay. Ready?
Yeah.
And go.
Uh-oh. Right, what would your weapon of choice be in a zombie apocalypse?
A machine gun.
What's your dream job?
Being a full-time writer.
Favorite TV show?
I'm going to say the Andy Griffith Show. Nice.
Worst food you've ever eaten?
Sushi.
Razorbacks baseball or football?
Oh, man. Baseball.
Whoa. Dream vacation spot?
Hawaii.
Celebrity crush?
I don't really have one.
It's okay. If you had one superpower, what would it be?
I'd like to be able to fly.
Favorite horror movie?
Salem's Lot, the original.
Nice. Favorite season?
Fall.
10 seconds.
Dogs or cats?
Cats.
Oh.
Favorite food?
Pizza.
Three.
Favorite band?
Two.
Metallica.
You're done. Nice.
All right, we got one bonus question. He got through all of them. We got one bonus one. So in the NCAA championship for football, if it's the University of Kentucky Wildcats versus the Ohio State Buckeyes, who are you going to root for?
Man, I'm going to have to stick within the SEC here and go Kentucky.
There we go.
We're going to end this broadcast.
The done. Wildcats won something in football related.
We are done. We're done. This is over with.
Show's over. Cut it.
Oh, man. Now that's cutthroat, man.
I mean, I knew he would say that because of the SEC. You got to stay within conference.
Yeah, I mean, I hate these guys, but, you know.
James is boycotting the championship where those two teams are playing.
Yeah. Like, what? Screw it.
So you were talking about before we went live that you started writing, like, really young, like 18 or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Has any of that stuff you wrote from then, is it still around to be read, or is it all kind of gone or been completely reworked? Or
I have reworked some of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's either unpublished or it's out of print, thankfully. or just, yeah, like I've got a big crate in the garage actually that's just full of like old stuff I wrote.
And so that's the vintage classic stuff then, Mitch Seaborn classics.
Man, it's hopefully it never sees the light of day.
So you were talking about you were young and naive in the beginning, and you published through that publisher, and now you're doing what you're doing. So do you think there are some common traps for aspiring writers that you want to talk about? Maybe a few suggestions, a few tips, so people don't go down that same road?
Yeah, like for one, a publisher should never charge you to publish your book. You should never pay money to publish your book. And like I said, I didn't do that. I wasn't willing to do that anyway. But I would say, yeah, watch out for the predatory presses, even if they don't charge you to publish your book. If they seem more interested in, you know, getting money out of you than selling your book to potential readers, go the other way. And I would say just do your research. I mean, everybody's pretty much got the whole world's knowledge in their hip pocket now, you know. Yeah. Google, use it and Google it and look at what you're getting into. Cause there's some great small presses out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm open to sending a book off and trying to publish through a small press or an indie press instead of just doing everything myself.
Yeah.
But, you know, look at what they've published and do your research. Make sure you're not going to sign a contract with them and then they're going to be doing what they did to me. Just, we're not going to promote your book at all, except we're going to send you emails about buying mass quantities of your own book.
Yeah.
There's been a few authors sort of recently that me and Jay have kind of talked to that have been fell in that trap. You know, Vandy Presses, mm-hmm. they pay what, like $3,000 up front for them to get their book.
Yeah.
Was it L. Stevenson or was it the guy who wrote The Diner? I can't remember. I know
The Diner. Yeah.
Diner.
J.C. Robinson. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the ones you see where they have to charge $20, $25 for their 130-page novella.
Yeah.
Just like, yeah. That just hurts.
And they don't have any say over it either at what the pricing is or anything.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that doesn't help their sales either. When it's a novella going for $25, or you can get all these other novellas for, you know, $10.
Yeah.
Probably going to pick the $10 one.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to stand here on a soapbox and tell you how awesome and moral Amazon is.
Yeah.
I have my issues with them, but, you know, at least they put some of those predatory presses out of business, and they gave indie authors a way to get their stuff out there on the world's biggest stage. So I'm thankful for that, at least.
So since that other press, have you had anything like book-wise published with the indie or small press at all?
No,
I've
published a few stories in some anthologies, but when it comes to novels, I've done it myself.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying I enjoy the process. I love the whole thing, writing and editing, revising. I've had some covers done by other artists, and then a few I've done myself, but I love the process.
Do you have a dream indie or small press publisher that you'd really like to get a novel done with?
I mean, I would love to potentially publish a book with Off Limits Press, just because I've been impressed with everything they've done.
They've knocked it out of the park.
Yeah, I mean, they were great to work with the anthology that, you know, when they accepted my story, I did this little happy dance.
You've got to do reports right now, guys. Go ahead.
they've been great to work with, and they do good work. I like every book they've put out. I've read, you know, The Worm and His Kings and Laurel Hightower's book and everything they've put out. I've been impressed with.
I've heard that Sam is just a treat to work with.
Yeah, she was great.
And just a case for those who are just now joining us, tonight's episode is dedicated to Laurel Hightower.
The one and only. And in the chat.
In case she missed the beginning.
She kicked off the Off Limits Press train with Crossroads.
Came out
with that one.
Yeah, that remains. I've told her this on Twitter a couple of times, but that remains one of my favorite novellas ever.
It's like great.
That book hits hard, and it's very well written, and it's still one of my favorite novellas.
James has a question down here. He says, "Is the most book done in your head before you put pen to paper? Like, do you have all the ideas in your head, or do you write it down first?"
No, I have a general premise and a main character, and I just start writing. And as the idea, like, the book kind of unfolds before me, and as it starts to get more complicated, I will start to take notes. You know, like, I got to make sure that this and this happens. And please remember that this character said this way back here or something. But I would be lying if I said I really have any idea where I'm going when I start writing. I usually have a premise, maybe an opening scene, and then we just see where it goes.
Does that make it funner that it's not planned out so much? Or are you worried sometimes that you're going to paint yourself into your corner and not be able to get out of it?
I think it's more fun that way. Because I feel like I'm kind of like a reader reading it for the first time. Like, I have no idea where it's going, so the reader's sure not going to know where it's going. But I feel like if you sit down to write a really, really rough first draft like I do, or you sit down to write this really elaborate 50 to 100 page outline or something, I mean, either way, you're just kind of feeling your way through the story.
Right.
And I just have to accept when I start writing the first draft, no one needs to see it. It's going to be horrible. It's going to be full of inconsistencies, and there's going to be entire, like my last book, The Things We Cannot Say. I decided about 3/4 of the way in that I was going to combine two of the characters. I realized there's no reason for this character to exist. It could just be this character. Mm-hmm. When I first took the red pen to that one, it was just entire pages X'd out, and, you know, arrows all over the place. But it's fun that way. I love discovering the story, and I love what that first draft looks like when I get done taking a red pen to it. So
you don't necessarily always do plot and then character, or characters and then plot, or it's just kind of a even flow throughout?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, I try to, since I don't plot anything, I just try to let the characters guide it.
Okay.
Like, I try not to, like, I don't want to do something that a normal person wouldn't do just to move the plot forward. I try to let the characters guide things and keep it realistic. And, you know, usually I get to where I'm going. Like I said, I may have to hack sections of the book out, or I may have to go back and totally rewrite some sections on the second draft. But
do you think that's the beginning is harder than the ending, or vice versa?
Honestly, I rewrite my beginnings and endings so many times. You know, like, I'll toy around. Could I add a prologue? Would that make it better? Do I need a prologue? Yeah, I'll have it. No, I won't. Or I'll I'll make the opening chapter this instead of that. And then, you know, the ending is also really tough.
Yeah.
Because there's a certain rhythm and beat to a book, and you want to end it on a certain note.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the ending can be really tough too.
Do you ever start out with, oh, this would be a great ending for a story, and work your way backwards to the beginning? Have you done that before?
There are times I'll have the beginning, mm-hmm. and then I'll way off in the distance, I'll know how I want it to end. I'm like, I got to get from here to there somehow. Yeah. And then, yeah, so that's happened at least a couple of times. The one I was just talking about, The Things We Cannot Say, I kind of had the last scene of that book in my head. You know, it's about a 55,000 word little short novel. And I had that ending scene in my head probably before I ever made it to the first.
Don't tell me it, because I'm almost there. Don't tell me it.
Yeah.
Laurel's got a question. Do you have an overall opinion on prologues or epilogues? I guess, do you like them? Do you not like them in books? Or
I don't have a problem with them, but I guess I'm not too fond of them, because I've written some prologues, but I don't know that they've ever made it into the final book.
This one sort of had a prologue. It was like the starting out with the court case,
yeah.
Closing argument. It's kind of a prologue to the Dustin.
That's sometimes I'll do that. I'll kind of cheat. Like, this is kind of a prologue, but I'm not going to call it a prologue.
Yeah, closing argument for this. He's pulling out his attorney lingo. Closing argument.
I just thought, instead of making that chapter one, I thought it would be really clever to start the book with something called closing argument. So
the beginning is the closing.
Yeah.
And Nikki's got a question down here. Do you have a dream author you'd like to co-write a piece with? You could say Laurel, since she's in the chat, and Tim McGregor is in the chat.
Oh, she would. Laurel Hightower would be great. Josh Marcella and Rain King both seem like cool guys. I would love to write something with either one of them. If they're watching and want to actually do that, hit me up.
have you co-written anything before with anybody?
When I was in junior high, a buddy of mine, we were both pretending to be writers. You know, we would write little short stories and then staple them together with covers, and you know, they were our books. And he was reading The Talisman, or trying to.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, you know, we ought to be like Stephen King and Peter Straub and write a book together. And yeah, that book was like 30 pages.
That could be like a sitcom, just watching you guys do that.
Yeah.
And not actually see the book written. That's just watching you guys trying to write the book. That's the sitcom itself. So
you've had the author, the writing bug for a while.
Do what now?
You've had the author writing bug in you for a while then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Didn't write an actual book length anything till high school, but I've been wanting to be a writer for nearly as long as I have been as a reader. So, but yeah, talking about that sitcom, I remember we were hanging out at his house, co-writing our book together, like right there. And I remember he would write a paragraph and hand it to me, and then one of us read our first page, and he said, "Mitch, we've said realize like 15 times on this first page alone."
That could be out the red pen already.
Yeah.
That. I mean, that could be the book can be you two trying to write a book together.
There you go.
Yeah.
Like super, super meta.
Yeah. There you go. Throw in some horror. And you got it. You got a hit for you.
But no, as far as like actual, as an adult, I've never co-written anything with anybody. No.
with you, and we've talked about your, you know, how you like to do everything yourself. Do you think you'd have any challenges co-writing with somebody, and you wouldn't mark out all their stuff or anything, or you think?
No, I think I'm pretty humble and open-minded, and mm-hmm. I would probably end up really jealous of a lot of the things. So I would.
He says that now, but if it ever happens, he'll be like, what the hell did you just give me? What is this?
It's in Marcella's part back. Like, hey, yeah. You marked out 10 of my 10 pages.
I mean, I think I'd be pretty easy to work with, but yeah. Since I've never done it, I guess I don't actually know. So.
Mm-hmm. How do you handle negative reviews? Well, because I never have any. Go ahead. Say that.
My most popular book, for whatever reason, was Toklat's Daughter. Like, I'm running Amazon ads on a few of them, and, you know, that one's been the most consistent seller, and it's had the most Kindle Unlimited pages read and all that stuff. And it's got nearly 30 reviews now, which by my standards is a lot. And it's had some negative ones. And I would be lying if I said it doesn't sting, but I'm pretty good at just brushing it off too. I mean, negative reviews aren't fun, but I appreciate right. all. I mean, I'm not just saying this. I really do. Anybody that reads my book and goes to the trouble of writing a review, I do appreciate it. And, you know, if they make a good point, I try to learn from it.
Yeah, that's my other thing. I mean, are you talking about negative reviews pointing out real reasons why they didn't like it, or negative reviews as in this just sucked and not really telling you why?
Yeah,
like when they just leave like a negative rating,
yeah,
one or two stars, you know, thanks for the feedback, but obviously you can't really do anything with that,
right?
But you know, I admit, I understand. Toklat's Daughter has a really, really, really weird ending. Mm-hmm. And I knew when I published it, you know, some people, if they come into this thing just looking for like a crime thriller or something, that ending's going to throw them for a loop and they're probably not going to like it. So some of the reviews were based on that. And when it's that sort of thing, hey, whatever, you know, I like the story. I write first and foremost for myself. Mm-hmm. And, I hope people like my stuff, but not everything's going to be for everybody. So
I think it's Ronald Kelly says, you know, you should write for yourself first. I'm sure he's not the only one that says that, but you should write for yourself. And if, or maybe it's Joe Lansdale. I don't know. If someone says it, write for yourself. And if other people like it, great. If not, that's on them.
Right.
I mean, I think you have to, if you're going to spend mm-hmm. hours and months of your life doing something, you need to be enjoying what you're doing. And if you try to keep up with trends as to what's selling, you're probably going to end up just staying a step behind.
Right. So writing for yourself, I mean, so you're looking at more like it energizes you. It doesn't exhaust you.
Oh yeah. I love okay. it. There was somebody on Twitter just the other day that said, you know, how do you hold down a job and write?
Yeah.
And then, well, I don't look at writing as a job. I mean, I do it because I've always loved it. It's mm-hmm. it's no different than going for a jog or hiking or just reading a good book. It's just something I love to do. So
I think that would come through in the book too. Like, you can tell if this person is passionate about it or if they're just trying to make a paycheck. Like, I think that would come through to the readers as well.
Yeah.
Are we going to hear a little something? Or
yeah. You want to do a little? You people taste of Mitch Seaborn.
Yeah.
You need to get your voice. Yeah. I was going to say,
what's your whistle?
Drink your little drink there and get ready.
So tell everybody what you're going to be reading from and what the story's called.
Yeah. So when I finally get done proofing, this thing one last time, cause I kind of have the advanced copy here. This is my collection that's going to be coming out in the near future. And it's called Faces Beyond the Veil. And this is pretty much every story I've written over the last, I don't know, nearly 10 years now. I don't write a lot of short stories. That's why I can take every single one of them and put it that thick. But I do write stories sometimes. And I'm going to read a story from this book. And it's we've been talking some about how my life creeps into my work, and This is about a climber in Colorado. So it's one of the two stories in this book. Actually, one of the three stories in this book that takes place out west in the mountains. And this is called Thunder on the Mountain.
Nice.
And are y'all ready for me?
Yeah.
Do this. Okay.
All right. Thunder on the Mountain. 4 years ago, Ian Henry's wife left the San Juan Lodge and never returned. But before Abby Henry gathered her backpack and hiking pole and went out the door, she kissed her husband on the cheek and said, "Wish me luck." It was 4 a.m. He was still asleep and barely noticed. But the memory surfaced after he was awake when it was clear she wasn't coming back. Because of this memory, he was back at the lodge for the fourth consecutive summer, still holding on to hope, still wishing her luck. Those who knew him well, his family and colleagues and students, had started shaking their heads long ago. She died on the mountain. He's got to know that. He's not well. But, he thought, God hadn't plucked her off the planet, body and soul and all. There was something left of her to find, somewhere on the other side of this window. He was sitting on the edge of the bed in their old room, watching the distant summit of Amaragre Peak become indiscernible in the dusk, thinking, "I need to sleep." And if not for this afternoon's thunderclap, maybe he would be asleep. But he had hiked up into the high country today with absurd fascination. He had watched the clouds swell, watched the lightning strike the peak's famous southwest ridge. The resulting thunderclap had rattled the entire bulk of the mountain. And he had thought, yeah, something like that. Because he was almost certain it was the weather that got her. She had assured him the day before that she'd be down before it got bad, if it got bad. But no, the weather that day had turned foul early, and when it hit, she had likely been picking her way up the ridge, completely exposed to whatever the dark sky unleashed. He thought again, "I need to sleep." This was his third day back in Colorado, and he hadn't slept well since he had been here. Surely he could lie down and drift off. There was nothing left of dusk, nothing left to see. The mountain was lost in the dark. But as he was in the process of removing his eyes from the window, he heard a metallic commotion from the door. The San Juan Lodge hadn't yet discovered magnetic key cards, and some confused soul had put their key in the wrong lock. When the effort did not cease after a few seconds, he stood and approached the door, looked out the peephole. He had begun to think as he crossed the room that maybe this wasn't entirely innocent. But no, this was not a threat. He had seen this woman yesterday. She had been checking in at the front desk, smiling in good spirits. Now, though, much like him, she looked like complete hell and was almost certainly not in her right mind. Her hiking clothes were dirty and wet, her ponytail was in shambles, and her face was void of color except for the dark, swollen pockets beneath her eyes. Her eyes. They were trying to focus on the key, but they wanted to look every way at once. Ian opened the door and kindly stated that she was trying to enter the wrong room. She forced a smile and started an apology, couldn't find the words, and when Ian asked if she was okay and she said something about being thirsty, he led her down the corridor to the nook containing the ice and vending machines. There was a plastic table unfolded in the center of this space. She sat down as he put $2 in the Pepsi machine and purchased a Sierra Mist. He offered it to her. She hesitated, accepted, and took several large drinks. "I'm Ian," he said. "You got caught in the storm?" She said her name was Andrea. "I got caught on the ridge where it turns class 3. I saw the clouds and turned around, but I didn't make it back to the trees. It struck right behind me. I had my backpack over one shoulder and it knocked it off. I went numb all over. There was a wind. I fell, couldn't find my backpack, and I think I passed out." She took another drink. "I was so thirsty. Thank you." "It's no problem. I'll repay you." "No, it's, if you'll give me a minute to find my room and take a shower, I could buy you a cup of coffee." He realized that coffee sounded good, and he hadn't had a meaningful conversation with a woman since. "Half an hour," she said. "It won't take me long." They sat at a table in the log cabin themed lobby, which was otherwise empty. Even the front desk was unattended. Andrea told him she was a realtor from Denver who spent most of her weekends in the mountains. therapy, really, she said. She looked better, Ian thought. Nothing like the frayed and dehydrated climber who'd so recently come within an inch of her own demise. And was there something else? A waiter from the adjoining restaurant stepped out to ask if they'd like more coffee. To heck with sleep, right? Andrea said. I'd like some more. Ian extended his cup, too. Will you repeat that, he said when the waiter was gone. What? To heck with sleep. Was there anything unique about that, he thought, really? Nothing. He realized he was staring at her, and now it was her turn to ask him if he was okay. He did not respond. Ian? Sorry, long thoughts. You haven't told me anything about yourself. You have an accent. Texas? Arkansas. He explained that he was a teacher, one of those who'd chosen to spend his life trying to help teenagers understand gerunds and appreciate Macbeth. Andrea raised an eyebrow. I hated Macbeth. He was still looking at her. Had he blinked? What you did there, he said, just now with your eyebrow raised. She used to do that. Who? Abby, my wife. We were here 4 years ago. She went up on the mountain and never came back. She set her coffee cup down. I'm sorry, Ian. I've been coming here every July since it happened, thinking, what if I'd gone with her? Why didn't I? Just because hiking isn't my thing? I come here and think these thoughts for days. At some point every year, I'll admit that I'll never see her again, and then I go home. That's who I am, and that's what I do. You guys want me to finish it, or?
That's up to you, man. It's okay. Your story.
I'm kind of into it now.
Okay. Yeah, you can't leave us hanging.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Give me about 5 more minutes. Maybe I can finish it.
You're good. Marcella's here now. We were just talking about Marcella. So he finally came in. He heard his ears were ringing.
I got you. He walked her to her room. It was just 2 doors down from his. His heart, for some reason, was thumping heavily. Because what you're thinking is insane. He opened the door, turned around and thanked him. She opened the door, turned around and thanked him for being kind. He barely heard her. Maybe it was crazy, but Abby was there, all over her smile, in and around her eyes and the part and fall of her hair. This sad illusion, and he knew that's all it was, persisted through at least a full minute of silence and staring. And then she was Andrea again. She had always been Andrea. I'm sorry about your wife, she said. We both need sleep, don't we? To heck with sleep. I think so. She shook her head. Memories of her recent close encounter with death were undoubtedly still at the front of her mind. My head is pounding. She squeezed the bridge of her nose. Oh, and I need to hike back up there tomorrow. I left my backpack. She sighed dramatically. Wish me luck. Her faint smile was very pretty. She cast him one more look, one he couldn't quite read, just a faint twitch at the corner of her mouth. Worry, maybe. Sadness, understanding, he didn't know. He was still thinking about it when she shut the door. These kids are costing me sleep, he said, pouring them both a glass of orange juice. He handed Abby her glass and sat down next to her. It was a sunny Saturday. Thank God it was Saturday. Oh, Ian, she said, the heck was sleep, right? You know that. You're a teacher. Why is Macbeth a tragic character? Would you like to argue he's not? You tell them what to write, they don't even use paragraphs. It must be because their teacher's failing them. You're not failing them. You get discouraged about this every year. That high school seniors can't be bothered to use paragraphs? That's true. About this time, every year, she was right. She said, let's talk about something else. Colorado. Amaragre Peak. I remember. The mountain of eternal being, the native said. It's been on my list since I was 20. You're crazy, beautiful. She leaned toward him and blew him a kiss. Her breath smelled like orange juice. Yet you encourage my craziness, darling. Only because you don't make me participate. Just drink beer at the bar and cuss teenagers. She stuck her tongue out at him. It was a cute gesture, one she was fond of, one that jarred him out of his shallow sleep with tears in his eyes. What if I hadn't been so lazy, he said. What if I had decided to participate? He sat up and listened to the wind whistle through the screen. Another dark hour on the edge of the bed, wondering where she was. He looked for Andrea the next morning and did not find her. She had mentioned, he recalled, losing her pack up on the trail, and so after breakfast, he started up the ridge. The morning was sunny and pleasant, and he encountered several hikers along the route. Approximately a quarter of a mile beyond the timberline, where the dirt path began to transition into a boulder scramble, he found a blue North Face pack lying 20 or so feet off the path. It almost had to be hers. Climbers occasionally abandoned their packs at the base of the final pitch, but that was more than a mile up the ridge from here. "So she hasn't come back for it," he said, and he decided to wait and see if she showed up. He sat down on a nearby boulder, read several pages of the paperback he'd carried with him, waiting for her or somebody else to claim the backpack. Nobody came. So he slung it over his shoulder. But instead of going straight back for reasons he couldn't quite formulate, he continued away from the trail. Not too far, another 20 or 30 yards or so, until he came to a narrow crevice that was cut into the side of the ridge. It plummeted hundreds of feet to the base of a massive granite spire. That spire had ended the descent of a millennia's worth of boulders. What else? He stared. Long thoughts again. Heart pounding again. He returned to the trail and started back down the mountain. At the lodge, there was still no sign of Andrea. Later, after having a burger at the restaurant bar, he knocked on her door and got no response. So he asked the man at the front desk if Andrea, he didn't know her last name, still had a room reserved. "Well, sir, that's not really something I should..." "I see you're concerned. Yes, sir, she does. I imagine she's out enjoying the mountains. Or maybe she's asleep." It sounded so reasonable, but Ian didn't quite believe it. "I think this is her backpack," he said. He briefly explained the situation, left the backpack at the desk, and spent the rest of the evening in his room reading, sleeping, thinking about how silly they were. Those thoughts of her sounding like Abby and raising her eyebrow like Abby, and "she probably thinks you're a weirdo," he thought. "She probably ran away from here without canceling her reservations because of you. Aren't you proud?" She hadn't acted like she was scared of him, though. Maybe it had come to her later. In bed, staring up at the darkness, thinking about the guy down the hall who was going to what? Replace his wife with her? He would have a breakdown and become obsessed with her and try to do something. "Oh, come on, I wasn't that bad," he said. "Don't be stupid." She sounded just like her, he thought. To heck with sleep. And then she had raised her eyebrow, and for a split second, it was her whole face. He dozed off as the sun was setting and awoke when the last glow of dusk was fading off the southwest ridge. He went to look for her again, faintly worried about her. He went down to the vending machines, through the lobby, out onto the porch, before finally finding himself back in front of her door. He knocked, and then realized the door was standing ajar. He nudged it open just enough, said her name, and stepped inside. The room was dark. He felt his way past the bathroom, waited for his eyes to adjust, and saw the shape of her on the edge of the bed. "Andrea," he said. "Have you been here all day?" She didn't answer. He said her name again. Still nothing. "Did you open the door for me?" he said. "I got your backpack. It's at the front desk." Only silence, and he seriously considered the idea that she was sitting up dead. He reached to his left, fumbled around till he found a switch and flipped it. The light above the window flickered and came to life. And what he saw before him, he would never forget. The woman before him on the edge of the bed was not dead. She was dressed in navy blue pajamas. Her hair was down. She was looking right at him. And there was a fine, conspicuous, horizontal line across the center of her face. It looked like a sliver of electricity, like lightning, that pulsing blue and white as it crept down her face like the light in a copy machine. Everything below the line, including her mouth and neck and body, seemed to be fading away, rising off her bones and through her clothes. Above the line, she was Abby. And this was not just some uncanny resemblance. Those warm and teary eyes, which were looking directly into his, belonged to his wife. But the hands, for now, were still Andrea's, and they were clenched together against her chest. Andrea's fading mouth was quivering with panic. "Ian," she managed to say, "what's happening to me? Please, what is happening to me?" And that's it.
Ooh, all right.
That's good. Almost some sci-fi stuff kind of at the end. I like that.
I almost wanted to know, was that like an autobiography? I mean...
autobiographical influences, I guess.
Yeah.
As far as I know, my wife's still here.
His wife, yeah. his wife didn't scan away.
Hey, just be safe. Just turn the camera around. And let us make sure, okay? Before we call anybody.
But
we have some new guests in the.
While you're reading that, Marcella came in and Rang King came in. Mickey got him to come in here. But Rang said co-authoring a piece would be dope. He said he's already got his gears turning.
All right, man. Just send me a message or an email or something. We'll get at it.
Write up the contract here.
The privilege of reading an advanced copy of Faces Beyond the Veil, and he loved it.
Yeah, I was looking for some early feedback and blurbs, and Rang King was kind enough to look at it for me and had some good stuff to say about it. So I appreciate that.
Do you have a date when it or a release date in mind or anything yet, or is it still kind of in limbo?
It's coming up really soon. I've got this advanced copy in. I came back from my trip to Colorado and it was waiting for me. So I'm going through it one more time, doing some last second polishing. There will be a date soon and I'm going to post about it on Twitter and stuff.
No, that evil Twitter.
We just went full circle. We're back to Twitter. Yeah, now.
We're back to Twitter.
Doing your own promotion.
How many stories are in there?
I think 3, 6, 9, 12, 15. 15. I couldn't remember if it was 12 or 15.
So I wanted to ask you some questions about Dust in Time, since this is what I've read. Especially, the author's note at the back. This is a semi-pandemic story. I feel like that's takes place more in the background. It's not the focus of it. And you talk about you wrote it in like 2019, 2020, sort of when the coronavirus started. Mm-hmm. Did you have any reservations about putting it out there during that time? Like, people have gone through this. Maybe they don't want to read a flu pandemic story, or did you just not worry about that? Or,
I did worry about it some. Mm-hmm. It's funny how it worked out, because like I said in that afterward, I don't really remember what came first. Like, the bad guy in that book was around during the original Spanish flu, mm-hmm. And I can't remember if that idea came to me before COVID started getting really bad or not. But I did worry about it, though. I mean, I'm sitting here writing this book and revising this book, and our school year had been flipped upside down. I mean, we went home for spring break that year thinking, well, they're just going to tack a few days onto spring break to give this thing time to blow over. And then turns out we had been sent home for the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. And so the COVID pandemic had kind of turned our school year upside down, and it was an influence. And I had thought about making the pandemic in the book COVID. But I decided against that for so many reasons. One, I'm afraid it would take over the story, and I really needed the pandemic just to be kind of a background thing. Mm-hmm. I didn't want it to take over the story. And I also knew that we don't really know anything about COVID yet, and I don't want to write a bunch of stuff that's going to be wrong on down the line. The pandemic's there in the background. I tried to make it a different sort of thing. I gave it a totally different name. It has totally different origins. I was thinking, what if people read this and, their own lives have been affected by COVID and they don't take it real well. But I think it's enough in the story that it does its job, but I really tried to keep it in the background. It's not a novel about a pandemic. It's not like The Stand or something like that. It's just, like I said in the afterword, I needed something to recall that really, really bad guy from the past.
Yeah.
And the red flu, as I call it in there, serves that purpose. So,
yeah. Because before I got into it, I thought it was going to be pandemic, like almost post-apocalyptic. And you did a good job. It's not that at all. Like you said, the red flu in the book is just sort of a background, more set piece than really affecting the main story. It's more, murder mystery, supernatural stuff than everything's about the flu.
Yeah.
Which I think was good. I think you did a good job handling that, putting it more in the background, not having it be the main focus.
Yeah. There's layers to that story. And, I think the murder mystery ghost story is a lot more in the foreground than anything to do with the pandemic. So,
yeah, so she didn't call it COVID. Yeah, so she didn't call it COVID in the book. Do you find yourself doing a little bit of that self-censorship? I mean, is there something that you won't write about? You think it's just too far? I mean, there might be a list in your head that you, I mean, you won't go so extreme, but I mean, how do you self-censor yourself to make sure that it stays, you know, a Mitch Seaborn book and not become like an extreme splatter book or whatever?
Honestly, I try to just give each story what it needs. And I guess in my own head, I have lines that, and it's not that there's lines I won't cross. Mm-hmm. I think it's just what I tend to write tends to be more subtle and spooky. And I mean, it'll push certain lines, but just by my own nature, I don't cross them a whole lot because I've always kind of preferred the horror that I enjoy to be on the more subtle and spooky side instead of in your face and grisly. But there are things, you know, if I'm not comfortable with it, like I'm writing that book and I'm, I don't know, 5,000 some odd words into it, and the pandemic thing starting to come up a little bit. And in the initial draft, it was COVID. Like I had COVID in there. And then I got to thinking, I'm not comfortable with this.
Right.
Not because of self-censorship or anything. Just, I don't know anything about this virus. Yeah. And who knows what we're going to know about this virus by the time this book's published. And so I thought to not date the story, and for my own purposes, just make it a new sort of virus, change the name. And yeah, so there are things, if a red light starts going off in my head for whatever reason, either just because I'm not comfortable writing it, or I think it may negatively affect the book, I'll change it.
Right.
I was going to say, I don't remember if it actually said, you know, what year it was or anything in here, but if you would have had it as COVID, that specifically puts it at, you know, that year 2020 and whatnot.
Exactly. Yeah.
Then it probably would have drew some lines. I mean, you know, some people might have looked at it as being insensitive to them. Mm-hmm. Some might have thought it was a joke. So, because it could have really turned into like a political book and take away from the whole point of everything else in it.
Yeah. So, I mean, COVID's an ongoing tragedy right now. And that was, I mean, it's affected my family and people everywhere. And and that's another thing. I mean, call it censorship, call it whatever, but I wasn't comfortable with the sickness in that book being COVID. I wanted it to be something that if you'd read it 10 years ago, it works. If you read it 10 years from now, it works. And I wanted it. I just thought, and you know what? I'm a novelist, so I'm going to just make up my own dang virus.
Was there something specific that drew you to the 1918 flu that you sort of wanted to do a story around?
I was doing some research about, you know, the town in that book is loosely based off a couple of different towns in North Arkansas. Mm-hmm. And the hotel in that book is loosely based off the Crescent Hotel here in Arkansas, okay, in Eureka Springs. And doing that research, I kept coming across some stuff about the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. The Spanish flu is what they called it. I thought so if this guy lived through that, you know, what would have actually been going on in Arkansas at that time? It's not a history book. If it serves the story, I'm willing to bend history a little bit as long as it's kind of realistic. But, you know, I didn't want to write about, say, yellow fever or something if that hadn't been an issue here in Arkansas at that time. Mm-hmm. So,
see, I like history a lot. That was probably my favorite subject in school. So pulling from history like that, I really enjoy that, especially if you mix it with horror or sci-fi or whatever it may be. Just that adds another layer of detail for me that I really enjoy in stories.
Yeah, I find myself, it's nothing I set out to do, but I'll get to reading and researching online, and history tends to make its way into my stuff somewhere, almost everything I write. So
if you were to sell yourself, you know, someone's never read a Mitch Seaborn book, where would you say they should start with Mitch Seaborn?
Either folklore, just because I think it's one of the more straightforward things I've ever written. And I think, again, it's got the history in there, kind of like Dust and Time does. And it's one of my favorite things that I've written, and it totally stands alone by itself. Or maybe Dust and Time, the one you just read.
Yeah.
And if you, on the other hand, I really am fond of Flying Saucer, because I've always had an interest in, some people think this is funny, but I've been to Las Vegas like 3 times and I've never gambled once, but I've, but I've driven up to like the gates of Area 51 every time I've been out there.
Oh yeah. And
that was the influence for, Flying Saucer, driving like 3 hours out into the middle of the desert and getting stared at by these guards and pickups and thinking how horrible would this be if I had a flat tire or something.
Yeah.
Cause don't they have the signs? Like if you keep going there, they just say they'll shoot you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all there. Yeah. This is government property. Don't go any further. It's going to be a bad day if you do. And, so I've always had a little bit, and I've never been into hardcore sci-fi, but I've always kind of like, to me, you can bring some pretty good horror in just, you know, what's out there in the universe. That's as dark and mysterious as some of the stuff we got going on here on Earth. And you can do some pretty horrific things with that too. And, so if you're into sci-fi at all, Flying Saucer might be a good start. It's not hardcore sci-fi. It's still horror, but
I mean, you can make it any way you want. And if the government corrects you, that means they know more than what they're allowing us that they know, you know? So
yeah,
like
this
a reverse trap.
I've been trying to think of a clever way to use this report that, UFOs actually exist. We can't explain all this stuff. I'm thinking I can use this somehow. I'm just not smart enough to figure out how. But because I mean, I wrote a book about that. But,
Flying Saucer Part 2.
Yeah.
You said you don't like to do sequels, but yeah, that'd be cool. You got James.
Yeah, the guy that did the guy that did the cover for Dust and Time, Neil Frazier, told me, I guess he thinks he can do some good work with that. He said, I'd love to do the cover for your UFO book. So maybe if you write a sequel. Nice. So there you go.
I need to get Flying Saucer. Bill Well-Read Beard, he sold me on that one. I need to get it.
Yeah. And shout out to Well-Read Beard too, because I think his review of Flying Saucer kind of cracked the door open for me into this whole community. So I've always appreciated that.
How'd you connect with him? Getting the book to him, did you just come across his video, or
no? He actually came to me. I had sent a tweet out saying pretty much that, hey, I'm looking for feedback and reviews if anybody wants to give this a read. And he reached out and said, I'd love to read it. Mm-hmm. So I mailed him a copy of it, and he read it pretty quickly and had good things to say about it.
Yeah, Kevin's a good guy. He's only about 70 miles from me or so.
Yeah.
We're selling books here, though. James is getting Folklore, he said. He's going to pick it up.
There you go.
Justin's adding it to the cart.
I appreciate all of that. Wow.
So once this is over, we'll take our collection fee. And I'm just
about to say, I owe you guys. I'm making
founder's fee.
Finder's fee. So I feel like just from what I've only read this book, like I said, but I've sort of read the synopsis for some of your other books. It seems like you lean more towards, you know, kind of the supernatural ghost stuff. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely.
With the exception, that's the one I'm reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the exception of Flying Saucer and, the things we cannot say, there's a little bit of a demonic possession element in that one too, but definitely more into supernatural. I don't know if I personally believe in that stuff, although I'm very open minded to it, I guess. But I've always had an interest in it, and I've been some places that just, they have this bad vibe to them. And it's made me think, you know, there could be something out there that I don't understand, that we can't know about. And I've always been fascinated with that.
Just a side note, whether it was intentional or not, I'm about 3/4 of the way in things we cannot say. And I saw some King influence in there. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but I started comparing it to one of his more recent stories. Not you know, totally different, but I just saw the influence there. So
what story is that, Jay?
The Outsider.
Okay.
That's, you know, it's Ross Jeffrey read Folklore. Mm-hmm. I think it was Folklore, and said the same thing. And I'm just going to say that I guess this sounds so arrogant, and I mean it funny, but Ross Jeffrey just said, you know, like Folklore was reminding me of The Outsider for mm-hmm. various reasons. And then he said, I checked the copyright dates and saw that, you know, you beat King by like a couple of years there.
I remember watching his video say that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. I guess just 20 years of reading Stephen King, this stuff just subconsciously.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you can't help but think Stephen King says in On Writing that, you know, this is all just sort of a way of communicating by, what do you say, telepathy? Mm-hmm. Taking his ideas and putting them in my head, and you know, 20 years.
A lot of his newer stories are about that too. So
yeah. But I guess 20 years of reading Stephen King, that stuff just kind of subtly comes out.
You'd probably be hard pressed to talk to an author, horror author, and ask them who their influences are, and not have them say Stephen King.
Yeah,
I agree. He's had the biggest impact on me, and just. He's like a one-man genre, practically.
Yep.
Yeah. I remember Ross's video on that now. Now that you said that, yeah.
Yeah.
Hamlin Bird wants to know if you have any crazy Area 51 stories. They didn't shoot at you or nothing out there.
No, they didn't shoot at me. I guess the most amusing one is when I dragged my wife and my she wasn't my wife at the time. It was just a big family vacation, and most of them are hitting the casinos or walking up and down the strip. And I gather my soon-to-be wife and my soon-to-be brother-in-law and his girlfriend into the grandparents' grand marquee. And we just head out into the desert. And one of us ended up getting a terrible stomach ache. And one of us ended up freaking out.
They had the red flu.
Yeah, there you go. And we ended up being out there way too late. Like, that made it extra spooky. It's like sunset by the time we actually get to the border of Area 51. So, but no, we didn't cross any lines, and we didn't get arrested. we did see a cow in the road. We had to swerve around a cow.
But, that's bizarre.
Kind of an odd placement.
Yeah.
That was just probably just beamed down just before we got there. It was just like, hey, we're done with this cow now. Who's next?
So is it just completely flat, just nothing out there at all, or is it kind of more hilly terrain where Area 51 is?
Part of what makes it kind of creepy is it's totally flat. Mm-hmm. Like, you come over this kind of low mountain pass. I think it's called, like, well, I don't remember, Coyote something maybe. But you come over this low mountain pass, and you can see the valley laid out before you, and you can see Groom Lake Road going straight across the desert. And that's the road you go down to get to the border of Area 51.
Mm-hmm.
And you get about 15 miles down Groom Lake Road, and then these really low hills start to rise up, and you start winding through these hills, and you know you're getting close.
Yeah.
And that's where you start to see these little cameras on tripods on top of the hills. You're driving over sensors in the road to let them know that you're coming, and you see the Ford truck start creeping around the hills.
The TV show sound accurate then. Yeah.
Yeah, it's spooky out there. And I guess that's what I liked about it.
I know I've watched a Ghost Avengers episode, and they tried to go out there, and they had all the signs, you know, if you keep going, you'll get shot, and all the, you could see the cameras, and the Jeep started swarming around them.
No, it's all there. And I guess the last story I have from that is I take my camera out and zoom in on one of those trucks, and I'm zoomed in on a guy looking at me with binoculars.
He's watching you, watching him.
Yeah.
That would be creepy. He's like, what's he doing? Oh, he's looking at me now.
Yeah.
Nice.
Crystal down here says she drove past Area 51. It was terrifying. Place looked like it was so locked down. You just feel like you're going to get gunned down at any point.
Yeah, exactly. It's,
and the cow is super funny.
Yeah.
That was no cow.
Yeah, there you go.
What a bizarre thing to see out in the middle of the desert, a cow next to Area 51.
Yep. Definitely makes you wonder how it got there.
Oh, it was totally beamed up.
Especially when like 5 miles ago, you pass a sign saying beware of like low flying aircraft and stuff.
Cow just gets taken out by a drone. Oh, man.
So we should probably let Mitch get back to the Andy Griffin Show.
Yeah, we've gone for about an hour 40 minutes. I think this is our longest episode yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So tell people where they can find you, Mitch. I know you said earlier, but let us know again.
Well, I'm on Twitter at MN Seaborn. That's my only social media presence. Other than that, look me up on Amazon. I've got an author page. I've tried my hand at a website a couple of times and it's just awful. So I've taken both attempts at a website down. I'm still kind of working on that. But for now, I just kind of let my Amazon author page serve as my website. So yeah, look me up on Amazon and Twitter.
Mitch's Twitter and his Amazon page. They're linked down the bio if you're watching. So
put everything down there.
Good. Yep. Go pick up a book. Go straight to it. I suggest it's the only one I've read. It was really good. That's the time. I totally suggest it. And this cover is awesome. I don't know how well they'll show up, but
yeah, props to Neil Frazier. He did that.
All right. Parting words, Brad.
Power didn't go out today. It was pretty cool. Nice to be here.
Glad I got to see you both, y'all.
Yeah, I appreciate you stopping by, Brad, this time.
I might stop by next time, too. You never know.
We'll see. All right, so that's been another exciting episode of Paper Cuts, episode 4.
Episode 4.
We're still together.
We've almost fought. It's been close.
It's crazy. Stay tuned. We have more stuff coming for you, future episodes of Paper Cuts for our special guest this evening, Mitch Seaborn. Thank you so much for stopping by. We totally appreciate it.
Thanks for hanging out, Mitch.
For my partner in crime, Brad Proctor, I'm Jay Maddox. Until we meet again, stay safe. See ya.
See you guys. Love you, Jay.
Love you, Brad.